Hello, everybody. Welcome to Women with Issues. I am one of your hosts, Tracy Maxwell Hurd, joined by my partner, Diane Calivras. And we are here today to continue our conversation on women with issues over 50. Our focus target audience, I guess, all are welcome to listen, but we're really trying to speak to and address the issues that are of concern to women over 50. So we are going to take a timely and personal dive into the topic of racism. Unless you've been living under a rock, certainly you've been aware of, you know, what's been going on in the world with the protests and the marches and Black Lives Matter. And that's kind of what we want to talk about today. It is particularly relevant for Diane and I because I'm African American and she's white, and we have managed to have a close and loving friendship like sisters. And, you know, when you're in that kind of relationship, you know, you kind of have those moments where it's like, why is this so hard for everybody? Why can't they figure this out?
Right.
But there's a whole lot of reasons behind this. And I know, Diane, I know you took a lot of time to research this, and you know, we postponed a little bit so that we could both have time to really get prepared for this. Diane is more of the scientist of the two of us, so she always comes prepared with data and research. For me, the preparation really was more of a calming than that kind of thing, just to make sure that I was focused and coherent and really gathering my thoughts to be able to speak from a point of calm and ration, because it is obviously a very emotional topic for me that, you know, I've dealt with all of my life. So I appreciate you, my partner, for wanting to be prepared, but more importantly, for just wanting to embrace this and take the time to consider it for yourself. You know, having your opinions and, you know, living in them is very different than thinking about, you know, how you're going to express them. So before we begin, I just want to say I love you, my friend. I'm grateful for the blessing of reconnecting with you as my friend and sister. And, you know, from the beginning, we've had a very deep and spiritual connected relationship that I've always valued. And I wanted to say that because whenever you enter into these theaters of political, religious, or racial conversations, you know, there's often a surprising, sometimes uncomfortable revelation. And for our audience, we are undertaking this exercise because, again, it is timely. It is relevant for us as Black and white women here. And we want to share the experience with you because we're sure that there are a lot of other women who are going through this as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's right in line with our podcast topic and hopefully for our podcast peers. I was going to say our demographic has reaped the benefits of everything that happened out of the civil rights movement, but now we're again seeing the erosion of a lot of that, you know, everything from voting rights to civil rights to reproductive rights, and now it's in our laps, in our children's laps. So that's kind of where we're starting from today. Diane?
Yes. So, well, thank you. That introduction almost made me cry.
Oh.
I feel the same way about you.
Thank you.
And I think that one of the reasons that we have been able to forge this friendship is because we've always been able to talk freely with each other. We've been able to have that dialogue where we've been able to ask questions. And I think that we really need more of that. People talk about there needing to be dialogue, and there people need to listen, and we need, you know, we need to listen to the Black community and listen to their concerns. And I think that sometimes there, you know, with white people, there is a fear of offending someone,
sure,
but non-intentionally. And you know, I can admit that I've had that fear, but you know, that dialogue needs to happen. We need to get over that. You know, it's time to get over that. And I think that the reason I am so passionate about this issue is because it's perhaps an evolution of my own recognition, I guess, of my own prejudice, my own bias. We all have biases. We all have stereotypes and prejudices. Right. They could be racial. They could be religious. They could be sexist. But we need to acknowledge that. And, you know, I grew up in a neighborhood that was mixed. And, you know, I think part of it is just my own evolution there.
Right.
I you know, I went to a Catholic school in a mixed neighborhood, and my school was mostly white. We had a few African-American kids, two and then three later on in my class. You know, I can't say, you learn things from your parents, you know, right. And not to say that my parents were, you know, overtly racist, but we were in the inner city. And, you know, we saw a lot. It was not a great place to grow up. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah. So let's talk about just some shared experiences. We kind of talked about this in our prep a little bit, but one thing that I didn't ask you about was, have you ever been discriminated against?
Have I?
Uh-huh.
Oh my gosh. I think this is a good time to tell a story.
Okay.
I talked about the neighborhood that I grew up in. Well, I can say that, first of all, being a blonde woman, there's the dumb blonde stereotype.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't get that much anymore. I got it a lot when I was young. And, you know, other women like me know it's not fun. So, yeah, I mean, I don't like people assuming that I'm not smart. And sure. I think I carried that with me for a long time.
Right.
You know,
right.
But I think I'd like to tell a story of when I was a little girl, we first moved into my neighborhood. And I think our side of the block was mostly white and the other side of the block was more black. There was a Black Baptist church over there. Mm-hmm. And my sister and I used to ride our bikes around the block. And this little girl who was African American came out and knocked us off of our bikes and started pulling my hair.
Mm-hmm.
And this happened a couple of times until, you know, I was afraid we weren't allowed to ride our bikes around the block anymore. But I do remember just being really scared. And she would pull my hair and say, "I'm going to pull that blonde hair right out of your head."
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know why she didn't like me. Right. I didn't know why she didn't like my hair. And it was just very confusing for me. And I would, you know, went home crying. And do you know that years later, I don't remember seeing her again until we were about 13.
Uh-huh.
And I saw her again in the neighborhood, and because we didn't go to the same school. I went to the Catholic school and she went to the public school in the neighborhood. And when we ran into each other again, we were about 13, you know, for some reason, we just started talking. And we sat down on the stoop in front of my house, and I said, you know, I asked her why. I said, "Why did you do that to me?"
Right.
You know, when we were 5 or 6 years old, and she just said, "I don't know. I don't know why. I don't know why I did that."
Hmm.
And I knew that story always stuck with me. I knew it was in there, you know, in my subconscious, and I think about it from time to time. But I think now this word white privilege has come up a lot lately. And
right.
I thought, you know, she didn't know how to say it,
mm-hmm.
but maybe it was my white privilege that she hated.
And
I'd like to know your thoughts on that.
I think that's a great story and a great, for two reasons. Because I think it is a demonstration of children acting out in their environment based on what they see, they hear, understand, fear, whatever. But it's also an example that racism goes both ways. You know, Black people are afraid of being victimized. And there are Black people who make white people victims because, you know, it's like, you first, you know, it's not going to be me. And it's a way of claiming power, I think, because there's, you know, there are so many other ways. And okay, quick story to emphasize that analogy. I'm going down the street one day and there's a gentleman sitting in the middle of the street in his car, and there's a guy leaning in the window talking to him. And, you know, they see me coming. I see him look. The guy doesn't pull over. They're just both still in the middle of the street. So I sit there. And of course, the longer I sit there, the angrier I become. And then another car comes up behind me. And, you know, they're still sitting there. And it just dawned on me. I'd seen that kind of thing before. But it dawned on me in that moment. That was that guy claiming his power. And I'm like, okay, you don't have a lot of power in your life, do you? I mean, that's just how that resonated with me. It's right. Like, this is your this is your time to own this moment. You can make me sit here. because I couldn't go around. It was a one-way street. I had nowhere to go. I just had to sit there. And I think that happens a lot. You know, we often, children are the best example, especially when you're talking about toddlers, you know, get angry and throw things and aggressive because they're trying to find some power. They're trying to gain some control and they don't know how to express themselves. And I think that's really the story you told is a great example of children not knowing how to manage that fear.
Right.
Of, you know, what they've heard and what they've been told, but not yet being mature enough to know how to manage that within their daily lives, you know?
Right, right. Yeah. And I think, when you keep a people down or you keep a people oppressed with systemic racism that we're going to talk about for 400 years.
Right,
Don't ask why they're angry.
Sure.
Exactly. Why they want to claim their power first, or they act a certain way, you know.
That's it. Yeah. That's it. Okay, I've got another question for you. Have you ever witnessed a Black person being discriminated against or had to say something to a white friend about something racist they may have said or done?
Oh, my gosh. Yes, I'm sure that I have. I can't think of anything specific right now.
Mm-hmm. And I have on both sides. I have, you know, witnessed racism from, I've been in company of Black people where comments have been made where it's like, okay, that's not really cool. You can't say that.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been times where that's not gone over well. You know, it's like, why would I defend, you know, a white person's space? Or, you know, why don't I understand? It's like, oh, it's not that I don't understand your anger. But, you know, it's a two-way street. You can't own, you know, or claim a higher ground and then not walk on it. You know, it's like the N-word. If you don't want people to use the N-word, don't use the N-word.
Oh, see, no.
I'm real clear on that. And I've taken a lot of flack for that because there are Black people who just think it's a colloquialism. Mm-hmm. Or even young people talk often about taking that word back and taking the power of that word. I don't think that can happen. And I don't believe that you can be angry with someone about addressing you in a way that you address, you know, that you with a word that you use yourself.
I agree. It's in the music, you know, you
right.
hear that.
And that's a problem for me.
I've seen it on TV shows now, and it's pretty disturbing. I mean, if you're going to call a word racist,
mm-hmm.
I don't think anyone should use it.
Exactly. But it's just racist.
It's not for me to say that, though. I'm white. It's not for me to say that's how
I feel.
Well, and
that's an ongoing argument within the Black community. And it tends to be, well, I think usually when I hear someone saying it's okay, it's usually a younger person and not saying that it's okay to use it because there's a theory that you can use it as a term of affection or endearment, which I don't understand at all, or it can be aggressive and mean and it just is what it is. I don't think it can have multiple uses and interpretations because it's just too volatile a word.
It is very volatile.
And you never know how it's going to be received and misunderstanding can lead to really bad repercussions. So I think it's just a word that we stay away from.
So what if it's a word that some people can use and others can't? What if you're mixed? What if it's, you know, what if you're somebody who can pass for white? I mean, you got to get into all that muddy ground, right?
Yeah, but that still doesn't give you any more privilege to use the word. Hmm. Because if you are in this country, if you are biracial, you are Black.
Right, right.
But
so, you know, many times by looking at somebody, you don't know, you know.
That's true. But I mean, again, it doesn't make it appropriate for you to use it in front of that person or for that person to use it. The word is just off limits as far as I'm concerned, period. It's right. Just, yeah. And, you know, people are entitled to think what they want to think, but, you know, I think that my interpretation of the word should make it clear what my response to that word would be also.
Mm-hmm.
that, you know, it's not going to be cute, it's not going to be funny, and it sure as heck isn't going to be a term of endearment. Mm-hmm. You know, if you say it to me, I don't care how you say it, and I don't care who you are that's actually saying it. Mm-hmm. I want to roll into something that we talked about briefly yesterday. There's a new book called White Fragility, Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism, and it's by Robin DiAngelo. And she was just interviewed yesterday on NPR, and I had the opportunity to hear her talk about her book, which was really, really enlightening, because I had downloaded it on my Audible, but I hadn't had a chance to read it because I just found out about it on Sunday. So I knew that it was a white woman talking about race from a white woman's perspective. And this is what I kept trying not to share with you when we were talking about it. I said, nope, I'm going to save that for the podcast. So when my friend told me she was reading it and had just started the book and what it was about, my immediate response was, I don't care. I don't.
What was it you didn't care about?
I didn't care what her perspective was. And the reason that I reacted that way was because as a black woman or black person, we have to wear two hats in life all the time. You are required to understand everything in white society, how it functions, what it means, how you engage it, interact with it, you know, and not just people, but systems and, you know, the culture and everything. And then you also, you know, have to understand everything about being a black person. That is not true for white people.
Wow. So, no, I never thought about that.
Yeah. That was why my immediate, you know, I know all about St. Patrick's Day. I know all about all kinds of stuff that have nothing to do with my personal culture. But because I move through this world that still, even though it's changing, is a majority white world, there are things, and I went to a white school. You know, you were talking about your school, and there were three and then four black kids in your school. In my school, there were a total of 10, and five of them were in my class. So when we graduated, that reduced the population by 50% there. So, you know, always being in that environment, there are tons of things that I know, and not just about white people, but all kinds of cultures, because of the world that I lived in. So that's why I had that immediate reaction was, it's like, you know, I'm tired of trying to understand a white person's position on racism. I need some white people to understand black people's positions on racism. However, this book is incredibly enlightening, and that is the word that my friend used when she was describing it.
Is your friend white or black?
My friend is black. Okay. And when Robin, the author of the book, was talking about it, she was talking about how, you know, we manage racism in this country, basically. She spoke to implicit bias a little bit, you know, and what you talked about, you know, that we're all have some racism or predetermined positions embedded in all of us.
Stereotypes.
Yeah, exactly. And she spoke about this country in terms of, she said, when we speak of race, we talk about it as if it only applies to black people, like the black race and racism applying to black people, because racism isn't something that white people have to navigate or manage, even though, you know, there's a white race. But although, you know, race is subjective, there's really no race, there's a human race. You know, biologically, physiologically, there is no race. But we have those classifications, okay? And I thought that was very interesting. And she went on to talk about how, you know, racism is the foundation of this country and the society just because of slavery and how it was built and everything. But she said, there is no neutral space in racism. You have to pick a side. You can't act as if, and she's speaking specifically to white women or white people in general. And she says, you know, you can't think just because, you know, oh, well, I'm a good person. I don't believe in that because of white privilege. You are living in this country under the banner of white privilege. So you can't say that you're not impacted by racism or it doesn't impact your life, because just by the fact that racism impacts me negative because I'm black, it impacts you positively because you're white.
Right.
I said, okay. And she said, it doesn't matter if it's conscious, intentional, you know, mean or anything, you know, and that's not the definition of it. And she said, that's why we get off track in conversations about race, is because the connotation of racism is, you know, conscious, intentional malice. You know, that's what comes to mind when you say the word racism.
Right.
But racism so much broader than that.
White racists are the skinheads, right?
Exactly, exactly. That's and that is true. But as you were talking about, you know, there is systemic racism that is embedded in how our government and agencies and, you know, everything, institutions operate, that is just, you know, it's almost like it's written in the handbook, you know, because that's just how it is. So that is. I mean, that, well, yeah,
this
and that
is something I'm learning now.
You know, 200, 400 years ago, 70 years ago, it was intentional. But now it's just kind of in the subtext. It's not written literally anymore, but it's still part of the operations of how these institutions and organizations work.
Well, of course it is, because the Civil Rights Act was only passed in 1968.
Exactly.
We're still not even a generation out of that yet.
That's it.
We're still not even a generation ahead of that. I mean, you and I were both born in 63, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
So
you just told everybody my age.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But, you know, she said, you know, instead of being offended when having a conversation about racism and assuming that you're going to be made the bad guy and all that, she said, just come to it assuming we're all racist. And the question is not, am I racist, but how have I been shaped by racism? Not if I have, but how have I been?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and which side of the conversation am I on? And what do I intend to do about that? Because she said, you know, the status quo is racism. And as a white person, you know, I live in it. And live in it in advantage. So,
right.
You know, that we have to take the stigma off of it and, you know, create that space for, to just assume, you know, especially since there's been so much work done lately around implicit bias and, you know, more people having the understanding that everyone has biases on so many different things.
I think the only bad thing is to not admit that you have biases, latent or blatant.
Yeah, you cannot move toward resolution, compromise, understanding, nothing, because if you just continue to keep the wall up and say, I am not racist, which is not true of any being, or to say that I have no bias. And maybe we really need to deal with the semantics of it more. Maybe in trying to deal with racism, you know, and I hate to give this a pass because I don't want to dilute the significance or the weight of what racism means to Black people. But maybe in order to engage in the conversation, we need to talk about bias instead of racism. Because ultimately, they are the same thing, except when you say racism, there's an implied assumption of hate in that.
Yes. Racism is an inflammatory word. You're right. Racism is a hate word. Bias is a lot softer.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know, and some bias is something we can all hopefully admit that we have. Nobody's gonna say yes. Oh yes, I'm a little bit racist.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly.
But you know, my story. I just keep thinking about the story with the girl around the block. Her name was Melody.
Uh huh.
And at that moment when we were 13 and, you know, we're both entering puberty and we were sitting on my porch stoop. And when she said, you know, I don't know why I treated you like that.
Right.
I think in that moment I forgave her and somehow on a subconscious level, I got it. But it isn't until just recently that it, you know, it dawned on me, you know, the white privilege part of it, that I could put it into those kinds of words.
And that's why it's so important that we talk to children about this from the very beginning. You know, racism is taught, but it's taught by example as well. It's not just simply, no, you can't play with Angie because Angie's Black. You know, it may just not be mom allowing any space for you to play with Angie. No, you can't have a play date today. No, we have something to do today. No, you know, just avoidance, you know, more than just, you know, directly coming at it. But I think that's why it's important to talk to children, because you have to give them the space to ask questions so they can develop the language to talk about it.
Right.
You know, Melody knew what she'd done was wrong. She didn't know why. Mm-hmm. You could tell that she didn't feel good about that.
Right.
And so you released that and you forgave her, but neither one of you really had the language to talk about what had happened or the why of what had happened. And I think that's important, because I think talking about it, and especially equipping children with language around that, is a way of preempting that.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, you're teaching children to recognize things. So when they see that, and when you've labeled that activity as bad versus another person as bad, then it's a self-awareness kind of thing. It's like, oh, that's not cool. I don't want to do that. Or I don't want to, or they may choose the opposite. They may choose to do and be that, whatever. But at least there's a higher consciousness of that, and you're owning it, you know?
Right. I think that, you know, with this, we talked about this yesterday, that the term systemic racism is kind of new to me. Not that I didn't, you know, wasn't aware that our systems were racist, but you said that that was not a new term at all in the Black community, and especially for you who worked in politics. But a friend sent me this article. Can I bring this up now? The HOLC?
Yeah.
So, because I think it's important. I don't know if this is taught in schools. And that's another thing. You know, 13.4%, here's my scientist sign, 13.4% of the U.S. population is African American.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't really know what they're teaching in schools now. But when I was in school, we didn't learn about Black history. We spent maybe a few days mentioning slavery. Okay. This is systemic racism. A friend sent me this article about the HOLC, which was created as part of the New Deal. So this is went on in the 40s and 50s. It's called, the HOLC is the Homeowners Loan Corporation. And what they're most famous for is creating the HOLC maps, which is signed. So see, you know what those are, right?
Yeah.
See, I don't think we white folks know. seriously, it gives a grade for risk to mortgage lenders.
Sure.
So they're grading neighborhoods based on their property value. And this went on all over the United States. This one happens to be using Minnesota and the St. Paul area as an example. But so if you live in the, for example, what they deem D3 or D4 areas, those areas had a large percentage of Negroes living there. And let me read this. So if you have a Black neighborhood and they call it D3, you can't, mortgage lenders are not going to give home loans to people in a D3 or a D4 area. So if you're Black and you're living there, you can't buy a home. You can't get, nobody can get a loan. So then the question is, okay, why not just move to a white neighborhood? Well, that was prevented as well because it was commonplace in the 1920s to the 1950s. There were racial covenants, which said that one could not sell their home to anyone who was not white.
Sure.
So think about that. You know, what is a person's greatest investment in their lifetime? Their biggest investment is their home. Still when you own a home, you have equity. You have money for the future. You know, and if you can't get that, if you're paying rent your whole life and you don't have money in the bank, what, you know,
it's intentional.
You can't tell people pull yourselves up by your bootstraps and then tell them they're not allowed to buy boots.
Right. There you go.
Yeah.
That's perfectly said. That's exactly it.
Yeah.
And that you can apply that to any American institution that you can think of.
Oh, the education system. Don't even get me started.
Yeah. Healthcare.
Right.
Finance, you know, I mean, finance is really tied to the home ownership thing. And, you know, when African Americans were allowed to have bank accounts and, you know, and when you could get a loan, not just a home loan, but a loan period, because, you know, another way of wealth generation is starting businesses and things like that, you know. So it was always about, you know, and I hate to say this, but this has become the theme of the day, you know, the knee on the neck, keeping people on the ground, keeping people unable to, you know, as you said, get boots. Mm-hmm. You know, in order to make that transition. And that's what has been the disparity across the board racially in this country, and still exists, you know, because even though the thing that's so crazy is there are things that have been outlawed that still continue to exist. Because when you talk about redlining, okay, yeah, redlining is outlawed. It's no longer actually a covenant that's written within a document anymore for anyone to see. However, 40 years ago, when my family was moving to the suburbs, my father was a big executive with Chrysler. My mom was a teacher, so I had two people employed in the house. We did a little experiment. There was a house that my mom was interested in, and she called and made an appointment, but when she showed up, all of a sudden, something happened. They weren't showing the house that day, and she immediately thought something was going on. And this ended up being right around the corner from the house that we ultimately purchased that I just sold. So she sent her teaching assistant there. No problem, no issue. Yeah, of course, the house is on the market. Everything's fine, whatever. Wow. So, you know, she called her lawyer. And she's like, I'm not really interested in the house. We'd moved on and found another house that she liked better and all of that. But she wasn't going to walk away from, you know, the illegal activity that was happening right there. It's like, what are you doing? So you obviously don't want a black family in his house, whether that was the realtor or the owner or whomever. I don't know where that directive was coming from, but, you know, that just happened, you know, less than 40 years ago.
Well, yeah. I mean, you asked me, you know, early in this conversation, if I have ever witnessed racism, I guess. And so many times, I mean, I can't even count.
Right.
You know, it's, especially in the neighborhood I grew up in, you know, of course.
Sure.
You know, all the time. You know, even in my own family, you know, aunts and uncles, and you know, we talked about this before. You know, of course, somebody who says, you know, yeah, you know, well, there are black people, and then there are
right
bad word,
the N word, sure,
okay. They think that's not racist,
right?
Say that because right. You know, I like some black people.
Sure.
And so I get it now when people say, well, I have black friends. You know, I can't be racist. No, you can still be racist.
Sure. Sure.
And you look to the inner city. Of course, the inner city is the legacy of slavery. That's where you see it.
Absolutely.
So you can't treat whole people like second-class citizens for 400 years and then wonder why they're angry, wonder why they're marching. But I have to say, I am really optimistic because I attended a march. I attended a march a couple of days after George Floyd was killed here in Ohio. And I have to tell you what I observed. There were at least half of the marchers were white.
Right.
And they were young people, mostly young people. It could be because we are still dealing with coronavirus that a lot of the, you know, I had a friend who said she's in her 60s and said she would have gone, you know, if she had thought that there would be social distancing and that it was safe. But the young people were out there, almost, I would say 90% of the people around me at this march, and there were probably, they say, about 2,000 people at the particular protest, and it was safe. It was peaceful from what I observed. They had masks on. People had masks on.
Right.
And I was just so optimistic because I saw Asian people there. I saw Muslim head.
The Jeeves.
Yes. You know, and it was a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
It really was. And, you know, I think that people, you know, no matter what your bias is, we all want to live in a peaceful community.
Sure.
You know, no justice, no peace is what they were right. Shouting.
Right.
You know, both N-O justice and N-O peace, as well as K-N-O-W right. Justice, exactly. No peace. I think that's the bottom line when you boil it down. Do you want to live in a peaceful society or not? Because sure. It's no longer enough to say, I'm not racist. You must say, I'm anti-racist.
Right, right.
You know, you silence is complicity, and that's reflected in what happened to George Floyd. I think that's what everybody's waking up to.
And it's not just a peaceful society, because there's been peace. You know, when Black people have, quote unquote, stayed in their lanes and not, you know, created any ruckus, you know, with the white folks and all that, there's peace. But there's no fairness there, and there's no justice, you know, and you have to have all of those elements to have a society that's functioning for everyone.
Right.
And, you know, when you said that you were encouraged, I'm not encouraged yet. And I'm going to a protest this Sunday, and it's being organized by Black women specifically, and Black women really kind of, you know, our age. But I've seen this before, you know, and I have to say that, you know, it's gone on. I'm not quite sure how long the protests went on in Ferguson. I'm not sure how many days that was. You know, we're at, you know, 2 weeks, maybe over 2 weeks now. I think probably 14 days now.
Right.
But, you know, the thing that I'll just say the opposition, quote unquote, counts on is that the good people will not have any staying power to really affect change. And for me, I have difficulty with marches and protests, because what always seems to be absent for me is the what next. You know, and when I was in the legislature and, you know, people, groups would come down for any number of different things, you know, I'd look out the window and I think, okay, you know, they're just going to wait you out because you're not going to be here next week. You're not going to show up in the committee room and testify. You're not going to, you know, bring pressure to bear upon not just your member of the legislature, but, you know, help organize in other communities. Because often when you're opposed to something, if your representative really isn't aligned with the community, you've already got their vote. You know, it's about getting outside of your comfort zone and outside of your community and, you know, trying to affect change there to get other people's minds considering this and, you know, thinking differently and bringing pressure on their legislator and to cast a different vote. And all of that takes work and orchestration. And, you know, you have to understand how the system works in order to affect the system. And I think people are very well intentioned, but I don't see enough people. The one thing that I have seen that has been, that I think is really relevant right now is the Eight Can't Wait is the name of it. And what it's all about is the eight pieces of legislation that must be passed in order for us to start towards some semblance of real effective change. And not just change, community change, but change within the system, you know, because, and, you know, that leads us to the Black Lives Matter.
Right.
And what, you know, and the marches and what's happening, but, you know, what is the expectation out of that? So the Eight Can't Wait are pieces of legislation that need to be banned or changed. Banning chokeholds and strangleholds, requiring de-escalation from officers, requiring warning before shooting, exhaust all alternatives before shooting, duty to intervene, ban shooting at moving vehicles, establish the use of force continuum, require all force be reported. That was one of the really big things. It's what, it's 50-A that New York is addressing right now, which basically lifts the veil, because part of the challenge that we have with bad police officers is the way the system is designed that judges them. Not transparent. It's not public. And, you know, there's just a recycling. You know, there was an anthropologist on NPR who was talking about the challenges that we have with the police department. And it's not that all police are bad. Nobody is saying that.
No, nobody's saying that.
The problem is the bad police officers have way too much cover because their process is managed internally. Their review boards are internal. There's no community input. You know, there are situations where there are police chiefs and commissioners and even mayors who have fired officers who've been reinstated by these very bodies.
I read, in fact, this morning, I think that in a second podcast, we, you know, we can address the politics of all of this. But I did read this morning that, well, Trump and Barr did call for a civil rights investigation on the George Floyd death. Mm-hmm. However, prior to that, they did undo something that Obama did, and they limited the ability for courts to enforce civil rights abuses in police departments. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what you're talking about.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And in fact, the Minneapolis police chief praised President Trump at the time for doing so.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And those are the kinds of things that are not helping us get rid of bad police officers, which mm-hmm. makes it difficult for not just citizens, but for good police officers, because, you right. know, all you see is the blue uniform and no one has any way of interpreting or prejudging, you know, when an officer's coming up to the side of my car or right. you know, whatever's happening, you know, you have no way of knowing which direction it's going to go because you don't know if it's, you know, one of the many good officers who are doing what they're supposed to be doing, you know, every day they're out there, or if it's one of the rogue ones.
Sure. You know, maybe one of the things that needs to be called for is exhaustive psychological testing. If you're going to put somebody in that position, you know, with a gun,
right,
and give them that kind of power, you know, I think ongoing testing, not just when they first join the force. I mean, it's a depressing job. You see the worst parts of people.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Every single day. And maybe there needs to be, I think there needs to be more psychological testing upon entry into the academy. Mm-hmm. They've already demonstrated that there were some flags that should have been acknowledged for some officers who ultimately were dismissed that just weren't. But I absolutely agree with you on the ongoing testing, because I know one of our, in Franklin County, our Department of Jobs and Family Services kind of rotates positions. You're cross-trained because of that, you know, because they are dealing with people every single day who are at their wit's end. You
know, downtrodden.
They don't know, how am I going to feed my family? I've got to find a job. You know, I mean, what's coming into them from their clientele every day is overwhelming. And unless you are a heartless, horrible person, you can't help but, you know, absorb that. And there has to be, so they have in-house counseling that's always there for them to have an opportunity to, you know, to vent, to blow off steam. And they have an opportunity to rotate positions also. So you're not always the one that's receiving, you know, the brunt of that, to be able to step away from that, you know, from time to time. And maybe that's something that we need to look at doing in our police department. You know, there's a lot of focus now on certainly the president, all elected officials, you know, that there are. We've had some of our elected officials here who have been out protesting as well. You know, our mayor has come out to protest. Joyce Beatty, one of our congresspeople, has walked the streets with the president of council, Sean Hardin, and one of our commissioners, Kevin Boyce. They actually ended up getting pepper sprayed.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, there are a lot of people who are getting engaged. There are police who have, you know, all around the country who have actually walked with protesters in uniform.
Right, right.
Who have taken a knee. You know, all kinds of really good stuff is happening. But yes. You know, that what next question continues to have to come up for me in terms of once the protests stop, or even while the protests are happening, what is it that we can demand and, you know, can be a rallying cry, you know, other than no justice, no peace, or Black Lives Matter? You know, what specifically can we say that we want? You know, like the eight can't wait, you know, those things, we need to really be putting those in the pipeline right now. Well, and in some states, I know that is happening, but that's the kind of activity that needs to be happening alongside of this. You know, our coalitions that are working with and going to our legislature and saying, we need this. We are demanding this. Who's going to carry, you know, which of you is going to carry this bill?
You know, defunding the police is the new battle cry.
Absolutely.
So I think that that's a, you know, good topic for another podcast.
Yeah, that's a big one.
Politically, yes. Where is this going to go?
Mm-hmm.
I
agree.
Want to continue educating our listeners about these issues.
Yeah, continue the conversation.
Conversation and talk about our candidates and how each of them is going to address this. I, as opposed to you, I see this as a turning point. I feel that this is different. I feel that this is the last straw. George Floyd is the last straw, and I think things are going to happen. I feel it. I see it. And I hope I'm right.
I pray that you're right, too. So, listeners, please stay tuned. This is just part one of two. In our next podcast, we are going to take this back to the politics of things and the practicality of it, and what can we do to undergird these marches that are happening and to reinforce the things that we say we believe in, and we want to see how do we make that happen other than just talking about it and feeling differently about it. What do we put in place to impact systemic racism and really affect some change that affects people's daily lives? So
thank you
for joining us.
I want to invite you to provide feedback because we are now on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook.
Yay.
All the Women with Issues.
So yes, please do comment. Like us, all of those good things, and we will be watching and hopefully have the opportunity to incorporate some of your comments into the part two of this conversation on racism. So,
right. And you can find us right now on anchor.fm and soon on iTunes and Spotify. Thank you for listening.
We're Women with Issues, and we're talking to you. Till next time.
Bye-bye.